Hello, this is Janet Gallen from Love Letters Live, the presentations by people, stories, and love letters, all kinds of love letters. Actually, any truth you put to paper in a loving or compassionate way, I consider a love letter, and I think you will too. For those of you who have been listening for the last 8 years, you know what we're talking about. Today's guest is a woman I actually met at a neighborhood meeting, took one look at her, and just flipped. And by the end of a very short conversation, I knew we were friends forever, and I also knew that she had a lot to say. And talking to her for a few minutes, I could see that she said it very well. It turns out that she is, by profession, a storyteller, just meant for us. So I'm going to turn this over to Jane and ask you, just for a little introduction of yourself, tell us where you're from and give us a couple of minutes on you and your background.
Well, I'm your basic New York girl. I spent 15 years in Manhattan. I started a career as a model.
Well, tell me, before you get there, okay. You had mentioned earlier that your father was in the military.
Yes. Well, I'm of a certain age.
Okay.
And so Dad was in World War II. And when he came back, we moved out to Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I got my basic education. The Long Island school system is considered probably the best in the United States.
Nice.
Just a sideline, I think my mom paid $7,000 for the house that we lived in, and we looked it up the other day, and it's now $350,000.
Oh, my goodness.
It's about 1,000 square feet. It's just a little tiny cottage.
You know, so distressing for so many reasons.
Yeah, yes. It really is. Yeah. But you're paying for the island, so to speak, Long Island.
And also, truth be told, people didn't earn what they earn today.
Exactly.
You know, it's still, I mean, people probably earned $4,000 a year then.
Absolutely.
Right.
I remember when my parents got divorced, child support for my brother and myself was $200 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hard. We were hard-pressed to make do with that.
Yes.
I remember that. I remember paying 35 cents for my first pair of nylon stockings.
Yes,
no pantyhose back then.
That's right. And the things that held them up.
Right. I believe they called garter belts.
Yes. Okay. We are of a certain age.
Yeah, we are.
Let's get back to forever here.
Okay.
So,
right.
So you found yourself eventually in San Francisco, but you are a storyteller, and you just said that you started out and you did some modeling.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your glamour life.
Well, that was kind of glamorous, and the fun part of the glamour was I worked for a company that put Anne Klein back on the map again.
Really?
Yeah. She was freelancing. She was no longer with a firm called Junior Sophisticates, which was Ben Klein. That's how she got her name, Anne. Her real name was Hannah Golofsky.
Oh, my. How
and
nice.
She married Ben Klein. She became Anne Klein. She was a very, very tremendous human being.
Uh-huh.
Died way too young. And so I worked for a company that put Anne back in business, got a small office, a small showroom in the building that we were in off of 7th Avenue. Right below us was Calvin Klein, schlepping his racks like everybody did. I mean, he was just starting out.
Yeah.
Just starting out. And so we put Anne in business. And I became, since I was the head model for the company that I worked for, Anne would ask me to come down and she would do fittings on me. And who would be holding the pins but Donna Karan?
Oh, my goodness.
So that
gracious.
Gives an interesting history of the Garment Center.
Yes.
When Mrs. Lohman would come in with her trucks at night and pick up the samples and, and the excess stock. Called her old Lady Lohman back in the day.
Okay.
So anyway, that's it. And then I decided to get off my feet. And I became, back then it was just simply called a secretary. And then it got to be an executive secretary. And now it's an administrative assistant.
Right.
And now it's an executive administrative assistant
yes.
and blah, blah, blah. So I got a job offer to come to California.
Oh.
To Tiburon, actually.
Uh-huh.
I came. The job didn't materialize. I came with a suitcase, $300 in cash, and $400 in checks in 1978.
Mm. What'd you do? I like these kind of lessons for people. How do you start a new life?
You just
I used to play a game with my children in the car.
Mm-hmm.
We would drive through some, you know, absolutely barren area on a road trip, and I would say, "Let's pretend you got left here and you had to make a life.
Uh-huh.
What's the first thing you would do?" And the game was to figure out what to do to survive and get
right.
What did you do?
Well, I came here because it was as a result of one of those great workshops back in the day.
What?
Called Actualizations, which was the heart workshop that came out of EST.
Uh-huh.
Stuart Emery had his office here in Tiburon, And so he, of course, when he was in New York, we met in New York. And he liked me, and he said we needed an administrative assistant to run the office in Tehran. And I said, I'd love to. But I had to do one more workshop. And the workshop was his girlfriend's workshop here at the Westerbeck Ranch in Sonoma.
Oh, sure.
So Carol Russell was her name, Stewart's girlfriend. And he had separated from S because he was having a relationship with one of the trainers, and that's how they separated, mm-hmm. he and Werner. Anyway, so I came out here, and his workshop had changed my life completely.
I can, you know, yes, I can see, and I can also see that you're so open to looking inward mm-hmm. and changing life.
Mm-hmm. It's trust. I learned very early on, even before actualizations, there was a course called the Silva Method of Mind Control.
Okay, first tell for our listeners, what is actualization?
Actualization is a workshop. It's your basic 4-day workshop. It was at a small hotel in New York City. It was actually a women's hotel.
What's the goal?
The goal is for you to find the essence of yourself and drop the mask.
Ah.
So I came in, and I was going through a very bad patch at the time, and I was very hostile and angry and really messed up. And a gal said to me, you've got to do something about yourself. And she said, there are two workshops out there. And she said, there's EST, which is the head workshop, mm-hmm. and there's Actualizations, which is the heart workshop.
Oh.
And I said, I'll do the so in my head anyway, I might as well do the heart workshop. So I came in on a Friday night.
And so you even learn from your own stammering to yourself.
Right.
That's wonderful.
What am I going to do? So I knew I had to do something, and I didn't want to do therapy. I didn't want to go that far. So I went to the workshop, and everybody, people going over, hi, Stewart, I've heard so much about you. Little, short, delightful human beings from Australia. Mm-hmm. And he had this great little accent. And I'm going to myself, who the hell are you, you little twerp? Mm-hmm. Why are all these people coming over to you? You're no, you know, blah, blah. Very, very angry.
Amazing you could get in the door with a chip on your shoulder.
That big. Yeah. It was really a big one.
Oh, okay. I can see what
so
you're saying.
So I was living with a gentleman at the time. Mm-hmm. And I sat there with my arms folded. And what the process was, yeah. was you got up and you raised your hand. You volunteered to go up on a stage in front of 110 people. And Stewart would ask you, what is your name? What mm-hmm. do you do? Where are you from? And he would go deeper and deeper
gradually. So it wasn't scary. You got to do it by increments.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he would sit in the back of the room on like a bar stool. He would just sit and, you know, on a stool. And you would talk to Stewart. And I'm watching people. Now, this is the thing that happened. After 3 days, I'm still angry. Mm-hmm. But I'm realizing something is happening inside. This is my peak experience, as Abe Maslow describes the peak experience of one's life. I came home on the third day, it was a Saturday, and I was crying. And my boyfriend at the time said, what's the matter? And I said, I don't know. And I started to cry.
My.
And the next day I walked in and sat down, and I'm still not raising my hand to be called on.
Oh, you have to raise your hand to be
right,
called on.
Right, right. And now there are only 3 people out of 110 left, and I'm one of the 3.
A holdout. I mean, everyone.
I was so afraid to expose myself. I was afraid of my own truth. I was afraid.
Do you know what that is that you were afraid
of? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was my heart. I was afraid to open my heart.
But do you know why?
It had been over.
Stomped on?
Well, since childhood. You know, you build a wall around your heart. And my dad, when we were, you know, together, was not a good man. He was not a nice man. Mm. My mother had problems. Mm-hmm. She became institutionalized after some years. She was a victim. And a victim mentality, as her psychiatrist described, he said they're very, very difficult to work with because she's so sure of herself. Neurotics, he said, are a joy. You can always fix a neurotic, but you can't fix a victim.
How interesting.
So anyway, I had all my issues, my daddy issues, this mm-hmm. issue, men issues. I was, you know, pretty and smart and a smart ass. And never could have like a decent relationship. Even with Michael, we eventually did break up. So I'm sitting there on the last day of the workshop and I'm crying. Mm-hmm. Just crying and crying and crying. Stewart looks at me and he points. And he says, "You up." And I went up on the stage and it broke. And what I realized is that I had one each of 110 people's thing. Whatever your thing was that you had to get rid of, that you had to divulge,
oh my,
disclose, the thing that was eating at you, whatever it was, that what you wanted to be, what you were hoping to be, what your pain was, what your what was it inside of you that was holding you back, Stuart found. And I was part and parcel of 110 people. I was one with them and the world. I was in bliss, and all I could do was say, for the first time in my life, I feel I'm sitting in a chair and it's holding me.
Oh my. So is that some, now I'm stammering, but I'm so touched by this. You didn't feel alone anymore? It sounds like suddenly you were not isolated.
My heart was opening. In other words, what was happening was all the cement blocks around my heart were being chiseled by 110 people, because every one of the people had something that was within me. A part of me was a part of them.
I see.
And so the cinder block around my heart was breaking, and the breaking were the tears. I was melting, and my essence, my spirit, my soul, whatever you want to call it, began to shine through. And as I stood there, I said, "I love you." And I started to run back and forth across the stage, clapping everybody. And they stood up, and they started to clap with me. And that was my great moment of knowing myself for the first time. I looked in the mirror and I knew what I saw. And I saw I was part of the universe, the clouds, the birds. As a matter of fact, my girlfriend once said to me, "Would you just wipe that smile off your face?" she said, "It looks like you're, you know," it was just, I was filled with joy. And so I volunteered to work for actualizations after work. I was still
there. I have something to ask you here, just to interject because yes. So there is a certain bravery here that I'm looking at, that you stayed. I mean, you were angry when you walked in, and you were angry, and who the hell are you?
You pay $350, you stay.
Oh, is that? Well.
Back in the day you did.
Really? Okay.
I wasn't going to give up. I wasn't going to give up.
Well, that's the part I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That's the part I'm talking about. There was some kind of strength and determination in you. Yeah. To do better by yourself.
Right.
I mean, that's really admirable.
But I also saw something that happened to the people on the stage. I saw people drop 10, 20, 30 years off their faces.
Oh, I bet.
When they found that it was okay and it was safe.
Oh, yeah.
And Stuart created such a safe environment for you to be yourself and say the worst thing about yourself, to expose yourself. So these people were so brave. They did all the work for me in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I volunteered for Stuart, you start kind of like ironing, you know, the tablecloths for the registration, and then you do registration, and you start to grow up a little bit into the organization. And it was all, and every day that I was there was a joy. Every moment of my life was, I couldn't even sleep. I was so happy to be alive for the first time in my life. And so it was.
How did you see yourself before and after? I mean, even physically, like when you looked into the mirror.
I had radiance.
Because you were talking about people drop 20 years off as
easy.
Because I guess constant grimacing,
pain
is aging.
Right. Your angst, personal pain, bitterness, resentment, anger. It creates a face that's unpleasant and off-putting. When people were able to release their most innermost secret of themselves in a safe place where they were hugged and loved.
And find out not only you're not alone.
Right.
You're not a freak.
Right.
And it's not so bad.
That's right. And so that when, if you have just a modicum of love for yourself, the world changes. Because it is the golden rule.
So did you grow up in an era or a circumstance in life when even girlfriends didn't say things to each other that were exposing the sourest parts of you?
I suppose that might, I suppose that's so. Because I believe that we wear masks all the time. And the masks that we present to the world, whether it's just the false self. It's the little self.
The part that we present that we think will be accepted.
The little S, self, in a small lowercase s versus the big S, which is the soul self.
Let's get to something that you wrote then. I know that you had done some work within a church that you had joined.
Yes.
And it was a women's group. Tell us a little bit about that. Because I want to give you what you brought so you can read it.
I was going to Glide. This is 1997. Mm-hmm. I was going to Glide Memorial Church. And Jan Mirakatani, who is an absolutely fabulous woman, poet laureate of San Francisco, was starting a women's group, a creative women's group for writing and for decoration projects. Mm-hmm. We did some amazing projects. And there were about 10 or 12 of us that met every Wednesday evening. And we would write and read our writings and work on, you know, what our project was going to be and Mother's Day project or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And what happened was there would be this kind of session of bitching and moaning and griping about their lives, the women's lives, that this wasn't working out and I'm not happy about this. And I was in a very positive frame of mind at the time. So I would go there and I would just go, what the hell is going on, girls? Come on. So I wrote them a goodbye letter.
Oh, I see. So wait a minute. So that was what, okay. So there's something about a goodbye letter that is such a love letter. I like that whole genre of love letter is the goodbye. That's very important.
And this and the thought in my mind was they were dwelling too much on the past. And today I know where that danger. That is a pit that if you fall into the pit you may never climb out of.
So
which is regret, resentment, all of the things that we were just talking about that hurts the heart.
So this really is a letter born of the love you have for them.
Absolutely.
Okay. Would you just read it to us?
I'd love to.
Thank you.
Okay. And now, goodbye. These are my final thoughts to the group because I cannot continue to meet with you. I need to be around them that's made peace with their past. I'm so frustrated listening week after week to all the negative recriminations and self-abasement. It gets me crazy in the head, and I want to scream. So instead, I'm going to scram.
Oh,
I'm not saying that I'm any different, but I want more. More up, more positive, more now, more here, more laughs, more yes. I want to laugh and dance and play and throw my head back and stretch out my arms and twirl and twirl and twirl until I fall down in a dizzy heap. I want love. Big, juicy, staring in the eyes while the world disappears, love. As you read this, you'll understand why. We all checked in and reviewed our week, our lives, our pasts, our aches and pains and catastrophic accidents. And what I see are incredible women who consistently negate their beauty, strength, wisdom, accomplishments by pretending they're still victims and believe that the past is stronger than the present. It's not. Why does it feel so good to rub salt in the oldest of wounds? Keep picking the scabs, pick, 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 over and over again, and not take responsibility for everything past and present, down to the fact that you chose your parents before you landed for the lessons you and they needed to learn to clean up some old karmic debts. Why continue to blame, to carry shame and guilt, and persist in the old drama? When does the curtain finally come down on Act 3000? Scene 1,365,000. It comes down when the drama queen / victim no longer needs her close-up, her audience, when she chooses to say it's over. Stage left. All the characters of our past are smiling, waving goodbye as they leave. Stage right. We walk off, glancing back one last time without regret. And a final wave. We've played it out and we're free. Best of all, we finally don't care if no one hands us a bouquet and says, well done. That's an inside job. However, here's something I bet you all didn't know, or maybe you did on a subconscious level. What would our check-ins be like if we didn't talk about the old, ancient, psychic aches and pains and failures of love's lost and world angst and the Sturm und Drang of present day miseries and futures of which we have no control. What would we talk about if we didn't talk about injustices, real or imagined, done to us and the whole fucking mess of the past? What a chunk of time we would have. Huge, mother-loving chunk of time once heads are out of the past and cease playing the coveted role of victim. Pretty scary, huh? What do we talk about then, and what do we do with all the time we have not thinking about all the past crap, huh? You know anyone that's got a perfect mommy and daddy? If it looks like that on the outside, rest assured it's a mirage, sifting sands of hot delusion and denial. I've said it before, but it bears repeating 1,000 times over. No matter how much you think about the past, how much unbelievable energy you zap into it, how many scenarios you write and rewrite and all the ever-loving it might have beens and weeds and poisoned wells and all the talk, you cannot undo it. As Auntie Mame said, live, live, live. Life is a banquet and most poor suckers are starving to death. So my darlings, get fat. Unlike the past, the present is wrapped up ever so pretty. And the universe can't wait for you to open the abundance that's yours for the asking. Just stop thinking, poor, 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 sad, oh, never going to get it right, no one's going to love me, I'm stuck forever, crap. Because when you think that, all the universe hears is all that junk. And it can't help giving it to you over and over again because that's its job, to listen to your thoughts. And if they're crappy, it doesn't judge the content. The universe thinks that's what you want and is more than happy to give it to you. If you said and believed prosperity, love, abundance, joy, and said, that's what I want, that's what you get, because it can only hear your thoughts and see your visualizations and manifest whatever you want. Check it out. Look at your life now. Everything you have and don't have is because you thought it. You cannot ever think of yourself as a victim because you made the choices, even to your parents. This is called metaphysics. Check it out. You are all my heart's beloveds, just not for now. Maybe later. Always yours, Janie.
Oh, my goodness. I have, in a word, nothing to say, but this just contains everything.
Thank you.
Oh, and does this woman not need a television show? Can I put that out into the universe? And I wish this were, like I
Maybe
say,
this
once
woman
in a
doesn't
while,
want a television
show. Oh, okay, this woman doesn't want a television, but I wish you could all just, well, you can hear the laugh and imagine the face that goes with it. That there is so much wonderful wisdom in there.
Thank you.
And did you ever get a response?
I don't remember, actually.
Okay,
I might have.
Interesting.
Probably what I got was thank yous and, you know, wishing me luck and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But
no particular,
I don't think anything
eyes.
Stands out.
Yeah.
No, I don't think anything
okay.
really stands
now,
out.
Now, I want to say that in writing a love letter,
mm-hmm.
We do it as a gift.
Uh-huh.
A love letter is a custom-designed gift meant for one person or one group on this in this universe.
Okay.
And we don't ever send a love letter mm-hmm. with the expectation of what are we going to get back.
Right.
It's a exactly. gift. And you send it out there. Sometimes you do get something back. And sometimes you don't. But the gift also is to whom? To yourself.
Right.
And having expressed this
mm-hmm.
and having written this. And I'm guessing that as you wrote this, the additional gift to yourself was that you clarified even further who you are and how you think?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's how I felt when I wrote it, mm-hmm. was both a combination of my feelings and to be able to see or feel that maybe I could do some good by letting them see what I saw.
And I, you know, as you're talking, it just occurs to me that sometimes, and I mean, this can be like our final word on this, I wish we had more time. But sometimes a goodbye is a gift.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
If you can look at the goodbye and see what is behind it and maybe learn from it.
Another time I'll tell you how I learned to leave.
Okay.
A relationship.
Perfect. So I was going to ask, because first of all, I can see why you're a storyteller. I'm just mesmerized here. And will you come back and talk about some other things? I'd like you to talk about your storytelling at the Asian Museum.
Uh-huh.
I'd like you to talk about what you just said, learning to leave. This is all important.
Right.
And I just love the way you talk.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you for doing this with me. I knew when I first saw you.
I loved it. Me too.
I know you did. I know you did. I think after 3 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 3 seconds.
I was looking for you that day. I remember that. I said, I have to meet this woman who wrote this.
Oh, that's right.
Project.
I'd written that. Yes.
Right.
Thank
and
you.
Then I was leaving and I walked over to you and somebody said, there she is. And I went over to you and then from that.
That was it. And you know, every once in a while in this life, you talk about the universe knowing what you need.
Uh-huh.
Every once in a while in this life, you get sent somebody or you, quote, find somebody.
Uh-huh.
And after 5 minutes, you have a hug goodbye. That is simply, this is the start.
Right.
It's not a hug goodbye. It's a hug hello, essentially.
It's a hug hello.
Well,
and
Jane, thank you for that.
Sweetie.
Yes. Oh, let's just do more of this together.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know you have a lot to say, and I love listening to you. Okay, so you've heard this remarkable letter, and I just want to say that, which I say, I think, every time on this Love Letters Live, that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, that writing a love letter is a special occasion. And with that, I say goodbye for now, and we'll be back soon. Thank you very much. Bye.